Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We have always a need to remember that that war is multi-frontal. It is one thing to focus, as we do a lot here, on the threats from overseas, because typically we're not paying attention to them or seeing how they are growing in kind and scope, because they are overseas. Unfortunately, there is also the home front, and it is increasingly the case that the enemies within are a very mortal peril to this country, as well as those without. A man who has understood this deeply, I like to think perhaps in part because he is what I call a foreign-born American patriot, and therefore has an appreciation of freedom in this country from having to live in a place like Cuba where it didn't exist. His name is Mike Gonzalez. He is these days a senior fellow in the Douglas and Sarah Allison Center for Foreign Policy at the Heritage Foundation. He has a number of other titles there. He's had a number of titles in the United States government as well, at the Securities and Exchange Commission, working for its then chairman, Christopher Cox, and at the State Department and its European Bureau. He's a prolific contributor to the public policy debate, thanks be to God, including as the author of The Plot to Change America, How Identity Politics is Dividing the Land of the Free, and most recently, BLM, The Making of a New Marxist Revolution. He knows a lot about the enemy within, and we're always pleased to have a chance to pick his brain about it, and that's especially so today. Happy New Year to you, Mike. We haven't spoken since the clock flipped over, but we're delighted to have you and hope this will be the first of many conversations in this very, very important year.
Hi, Frank, and a Happy New Year to you. You're right in that we do have a threat to our security from without, and we have China, Iran, and Russia that are always ready to create havoc for us, and of course Cuba, Venezuela, and so forth. I had a meeting with some foreign visitors yesterday, and they told me that Iran is 2 months away from having the capability of building a bomb, and that the Biden administration has been very stupidly, in my view, has been trying to sabotage the Abraham Accords and achievements just because Trump made them. But the thing that really has concentrated my attention are, as bad as things are internationally, is the domestic threat to our freedoms. Because I think that the domestic Marxists who have taken over the commanding heights of our culture have already achieved something that the Soviets never achieved, which is subjugating Americans to a great degree. We live with less liberty. We are afraid to say, to say in public the things we believe. In fact, 60% of us admit in a Cato poll last year that we self-censor. We are being constantly accosted at our places of work and at school with ideologies we disagree with, and we're being told to do this or face HR, the long arm of HR, and possible unemployment and cancellation, not just socially, but employing wise. So we're facing an environment, a liberty environment, that is much more impoverished than we did 10 years ago. And we really need to take this very seriously, because unless we do something about it, it will get worse.
Absolutely. Mike, back the lens up just a little bit, if you would, because I think not so much this audience, because we work at working through these topics a lot here, and I think our folks are pretty well steeped in how this has happened. But just as a point of reference, you have lived under communism in Cuba, as I recall, and it's an unbelievable story about how a country like the United States, which for a long time understood the threat of communism, regarded it as a mortal enemy of freedom, as you say, and wanted no part of it, has now come to a point where large percentages of particularly younger Americans think socialism or progressivism or, well, even Marxism, I think, probably, would be a preferable, you know, social and political system to the one that we have in this country. How has it come to pass that we have had this degree of subjugation, as you call it?
America has been exceptional when it comes to freedom. And this is something that has been remarked by foreign observers from the Tocqueville on down, you know, Chesterton. In fact, the very idea of exceptionalism is supposed to have been started by Joseph Stalin in a telegram in the 1920s, when the head of the American Communist Party, I think his name at the time was J. Lovejoy, I may be getting this wrong, had cabled Stalin and said that the American worker was not going to rise up and lead a revolution. And Stalin shot back, "What is this I hear about American exceptionalism?" People, when the scholars of the Frankfurt School came to the United States, they were fascinated by us, but they also were really disappointed by how attached to liberty we were. And you're right to bring up my foreign birth, because a question, you know, Jimmy Lai, as you know, a very strong defender of freedom, who's now behind bars in Hong Kong because China took over Hong Kong, has destroyed Hong Kong as a place of liberty. He's a good friend of mine, and he once told me, freedom is like oxygen. You take oxygen for granted until someone tries to choke you. Then you do everything within your power to regain oxygen. And I always questioned, even before I heard this from Jimmy, which I did about two decades ago, I always questioned myself, you know, Americans have never lost their freedom. How come they're so attached to freedom? And I think it has to do with the way we're constituted, the way the founders and the framers constituted the nation through the Constitution. You know, Aristotle was very firm about this, that it is the way we're constituted that determines how we live. So I think that as we have gotten away from the Constitution of 87, and we are people, you know, our government has been doing unconstitutional things, especially under Biden, that's now on steroids, this idea that we can dispense government services according to race, this is all very unconstitutional. So the more we have gotten away from the way we're constituted, the more we're going to become victims of subjugation, which is what is happening.
So you mentioned the Frankfurt School and this gaggle of scholars, academics, Marxist revolutionaries, I would call them, who migrated from Nazi Germany to the United States and set up shop, I think many of them at Columbia University in the teachers' college there, and set about doing the march through the institutions, as it was called, beginning with academia. And now we've had several generations of Americans who have been brainwashed, indoctrinated, seduced, whatever verb you wish to use, by this notion that a more equitable arrangement, one that assures equal outcomes, not equal opportunities, and that dispenses with that Constitution of 87, as you said, 1787, that is, to the point where we wind up you know, with something approximating a tyrannical one-party state, which we see in lots of other places around the world, including, as you mentioned, in Latin America. We've lost two countries since we last talked, I think, about this, Mike, Peru and Chile to communists, and Brazil and Colombia may be next. Give us a sense of the kind of counter-revolution that is required by these sorts of circumstances here in the United States and with our help, hopefully elsewhere as well.
Well, it's very interesting that you mentioned the march through the institutions, right? There are two ways of gaining power. One is through violence, for communists to gain power. One is through a violent revolution, which is what Marx called for in the manifesto, right? Marx believed in a violent revolution, and then he said that once the government would start taking people's properties away, people were going to rise up in opposition, and there would be a need for what he called in the manifesto despotic inroads. He admits that communists are going to have to be despotic to take people's stuff away. But there's another way, right? There's another way. And then because later Marxists, those in the Frankfurt School in Germany and Antonio Gramsci in Italy, when they saw 70 years later that had only happened in one place, Russia, and not an industrialized place, which is what Marx called for, but industrialized societies had defeated Marxists, Germany and Italy, they came up with the cultural way of gaining power. And they said, well, the reason the worker is not rising is because, unlike what Marx predicted, the government, the worker likes the family, likes his family, which Marx said that needed to be abolished. The worker likes
the so-called
God.
Nuclear family, right?
Right, right. The worker likes God. He is loyal to God, which Marx said was just an opium for the people. The worker liked his country. He was patriotic, which Marx had said needed to be abolished as well. And the worker liked private property. He liked his lot of land or his house, which Marx had said needed to be abolished as well. So they thought, these neo-communists in the 20s and 30s, that the worker had false consciousness and needed to be indoctrinated. We needed to go to work on the... And it's this really... This is what happens. The phrase, the long march through the institutions, really belongs to Rudi Dutschke, a German disciple of the Frankfurt School scholar Herbert Marcuse. And he comes up with it in 1967. And let's not forget... Let's go back to this historical period, Frank, because in the 60s, the revolutionaries, the Black Panthers, the Weathermen, the Students for a Democratic Society, they thought that there was going to be violent revolution. You know, Bill Ayers thought he was going to be Che Guevara. They looked at Castro and Guevara and said, here are two white university students that are able to launch a revolution in the name of social justice. And by 67, they begin to realize the revolution ain't going to happen. Sure, they go into terrorism and they continue to try in the 70s. And that's when Dutschke comes up with the long march through the institutions. And he writes to Marcuse. Marcuse writes back saying, brilliant, this is what we need. And then it's no surprise that decades later, we have the media, the academy, all of the cultural commanding heights taken over by Marxists. What does Bill Ayers, let me just finish with this. What does Bill Ayers do when he comes out of hiding? The weatherman, the member of the weather underground terrorist, he's pursued by the FBI. He has to go underground, and then he's able to emerge because I think it was Carter who pardoned him. What does he do? He goes to Teachers College and gets a PhD in education. Obama called them an educational reformer. It's like calling Stalin an agricultural reformer.
And I think Bill Ayers called Obama one of his proteges, if I'm not mistaken, as well.
Exactly.
But let me ask you this before we run out of time. Mike Gonzalez, again, is our guest from the Heritage Foundation. You described very neatly, you know, the central pillars of the workers' love for our country and, you know, sense of... Well, what's important in their lives, whether it's their families, whether it's their religious beliefs, whether it's their country, their property. The Marxist of the current era, notably those influenced by Mao Zedong, have adopted a new, more intense program of action, it would seem, a real revolution. Some call them color revolutions, cultural revolutions that have had as a centerpiece not so much class as race. And you've written this book about Black Lives Matter and the extent to which it really does constitute a new Marxist revolutionary operation. Talk about the cumulative effect, if you would, Mike, of this Marxist agenda, whether it's critical race theory or whether it's the efforts to purge the Pentagon, for example, of people who are not sufficiently imbued with this sense of the new order on race, if you will, and where it's leading our country, and therefore why this counter-revolution is that you've called for and described is so urgently required.
Black Lives Matter, to which I devoted my book, as you rightly said, BLM, The Making of a New Marxist Revolution, is founded by people who were trained by these former weathermen, by people who were Gramscians. Alicia Garza was trained at the school of, Alicia Garza, one of the founders of Black Lives Matter, is trained at the School of Unity and Liberation, which is founded in the 1990s by Harmony Goldberg, a PhD in cultural anthropology, who's an expert on Gramsci. And she says exactly what we need to do in order to take over the culture and to apply Gramsci's war of position. Critical race theory is all about Gramsci. Kimberlé Crenshaw, in one of the founding essays of critical race theory, says exactly that. She says explicitly, we need to adopt Gramsci's war of position. And the war of position is this idea of infiltrating society, taking over the cultural institutions, and deprogramming Americans from their attachment to liberty and teaching them the new hegemony, the counter-hegemony, one that is nothing but Marxist goals hiding behind the pretense of social justice and racial equity. They don't care at all about race. The only reason that why they latched onto race is because they realized that the social classes are mutable, especially in America, especially under capitalism. One can change his station of life. I have been poor. I have been middle class. I haven't been comfortable in one's life. I mean, I ate at a soup kitchen once as a child, Frank. So one goes through different stages of life. With the things that you cannot change are your race, your national origin, or here comes the news flash, or your sex. So it's better to fix, to find the revolutionary agents according to conditions that are immutable. And that's what they have done.
And what they are trying to do is to destroy this country, make no mistake about it.
Well, they say this.
Are hard at it, right?
No, they say this. Alicia Garza says, what we need to do is dismantle the organizing principle of society, how we've organized as a society. They don't hide this goal.
Fundamental transformation, as Barack Obama, community organizer, put it, I think. Talk a little bit about, quickly, Mike, if you would, we've only got a couple more minutes, but the parents that you see as kind of the leading edge of the counter-revolution that's needed. And we're talking, obviously, of a peaceful restoration of our Constitution, not a violent revolution or counter-revolution. But we are having these parents in school boards in Northern Virginia and other places described as domestic terrorists, that's to be sure, by the Department of Justice. But what are they doing? How important is it? And Greg Youngkin, who has just become governor of Virginia, has benefited greatly from their support. Talk a little bit about where we go from here.
They're saving the country. They're saving the country because they love their jobs. They don't want their places of jobs, of work, to become a center for a struggle session, a Maoist struggle session. They love their children. They don't want their children to be indoctrinated into this repugnant ideology, and they don't. And they love their country. They don't want their country to change. And they don't have to read Kimberlé Crenshaw or Derek Bell to understand these matters. They have an instinct for freedom. This is I went to about maybe 25 cities last year. And what I saw is intellectually curious parents and workers who came to my talks, asked good probing questions, asked what can I do, and I tried my best to define how critical race theory came from critical legal studies, which came from critical theory, which comes from Marx. And they were very interested in this, and I'm continuing again. Last week I was in Miami. I'm going to travel to Charleston next month, talk about my book, BLM. What I say in BLM, Frank, is I quote them. I quote leftist sources. It's all out there for the media to quote and cite, except they refuse to do it. The media only talks about Black Lives Matter, they about the concept. And the concept is beautiful. Black lives do matter. I say this. I don't say all lives matter. Obviously, all lives do matter, but I say Black Lives Matter. It's important to affirm the importance of Black lives. But they talk about the movement, which I guess is the kids marching and the people putting signs on their lawns, but they don't talk about the organizations. When you Google Black Lives Matter, it takes you to the Black Lives Matter Global Network Foundation. That's what Google takes you to. That is blacklivesmatter.com. That was founded by Marxists who want to destroy the family, who want to destroy capitalism, who say all these things.
Destroy the United States of America in the process and have been hard at it, as I say, notably in the so-called Summer of Love in 200 cities across this country.
Very successful.
No insurrection there, we're told, but it sure looked like one to me. Mike Gonzalez, we have to leave it at that for the moment. I hope that, as I said earlier, this conversation will be one that we will return to frequently with you in 2022, because your clarity and courage in describing what we confront here in the enemy within is so vital and so appreciated and so needed. So we'll talk with you again very soon, my friend. In the meantime, stay well. Keep up the great work at the Heritage Foundation. God bless
you. Thanks, Frank.
Next up, we'll speak with Sam Faddis. We'll talk with him about other things, about the Islamist piece of this enemy within and the various dangers we're facing overseas as well. Driving force behind AND Magazine, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and it's a delight always to be able to say we're joined by Sam Faddis, Charles Sam Faddis, a former Army officer who became a former undercover Central Intelligence Agency clandestine officer. He has gone on to do other things, including a number of books that he's authored, including among them Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the Central Intelligence Agency. He has also been a candidate for the United States Congress. He has served as an assistant attorney general in the state of Washington. He has been an incredibly impactful contributor to the public policy debate, notably as a member of our Committee on the Present Danger China, co-author with Trevor Loudon of a number of very important pieces about the compromise of American officials at the Accountability Initiative. That's accountabilityinitiative.org. And not least, in his own very, very helpful online resource, andmagazine.com. It's always great to catch up with him. Sam, welcome back.
Great to be here, Frank. Thank you.
I wanted to pick up with you on a kind of segue to the enemy within conversation I was just having with Mike Gonzalez, which is to say, talking about, well, the Marxists, if you care to, the Black Lives Matter types and so on, but their partners in what we call the Red-Green Axis, the Muslim Brotherhood and other Sharia supremacists. You went up against such guys in garden spots of the universe like Pakistan for many years, so I know you know a lot about Sharia supremacism. What do we need to know, Sam, particularly against the backdrop of this hostage-taking jihadist operation in Colleyville, Texas, on Saturday, in a Jewish synagogue in which fortunately, nobody was killed other than the jihadist himself, praise be to God. But it seems that he was all about springing from an American jail, a woman by the name of Fia Siddiqui, who is a very dubious customer, indeed, to put it mildly. But her release from jail is a shared priority of most of the most prominent Muslim Brotherhood front groups in the United States. What is up with all of that? And what should we know about it in terms of this enemy within problem?
Right. Well, Afia Siddiqui is somebody with whom actually I have some substantial familiarity because I did a lot of weapons of mass destruction work with the CIA, and my last job there was running the unit that hunted terrorist weapons of mass destruction programs worldwide. So, you know, as with a lot of things, there's this narrative that gets spread around on the internet to paint her as some sort of poor, misunderstood young lady who was wrong place, wrong time, and abused and so forth, and whatever layers you want to throw on that, which is which is really laughable, I mean, and heinous, because this lady, when she was picked up, had already been on the FBI's most wanted list for a long time. She was on our list of top tier folks to hunt worldwide for years before she was taken off the street in Pakistan. She is a very, very highly educated, U.S. educated scientist, hard scientist. And I think she got her PhD from Brandeis, if I recall correctly. And when they grabbed her off the street, which again was not some random thing, this is a lady who had been, you know, in the short list of people that have to be taken off the street to protect the United States from weapons of mass destruction, this lady was right up there. When they grabbed her, as I recall, she was carrying in hard copy and in electronic form, I think, a thumb drive, a whole bunch of manuals, and a lot of information about construction of terrorist weapons of mass destruction devices. Not random, a couple of articles you pulled off the internet. This is stuff on how to build it. She was also carrying cyanide, a substantial portion. And she also had lists of landmarks in New York, which are, and again, this is not a tourist map like she was going on vacation. This is evidence of substantial casing of specific targets in New York City. And one of the primary, a primary focus of Al-Qaeda at the time, so I think she was arrested in 2008, was on the use of devices to be placed in mass transit, subways and trains and so forth, which would generate cyanide gas. They had created a design for a device which they called the Mubtalker, which was a relatively easy to construct device, which would you could be put in a bag and just dumped in subways and trains. You know, you can imagine in New York where mass transit is a huge deal, multiple such devices underground in cars generating cyanide gas. So the idea was to kill probably thousands of Americans. And she was carrying, they were way down the road on this. She had the list of targets. She had cyanide. She was the designer. She's at the heart of this thing. So anybody who stands up and tells you that they want to put Afia Siddiqui back on the street is either absolutely abjectly ignorant, or they are advocating for mass murder of American citizens. That's as clear as day.
Playing this lady, for the other team is
by the other. This lady was at the heart of this. By the way, I should add, without getting too long-winded, I mean, she was in direct contact with the very top tier of Al-Qaeda leadership, which is, by the way, all of Al-Qaeda's weapons of mass destruction programs have always been run directly from the center. These are not peripheral people. Like, they report directly to reported directly to bin Laden and the people immediately around him. So this is a lady at the very top of Al-Qaeda's efforts to figure out ways to carry on an attack as a follow-on to 9/11 that would make 9/11 look like a good day. That's what this lady was all about and still is all about.
So my point is that when you have organizations like the Council on American Islamic Relations, and the U.S. Council of Muslim Organizations and the Islamic Society of North America and others that are prominent in the Muslim Brotherhood infrastructure in the United States, saying basically the same thing that this jihadist hostage taker was saying. You've got to free Afia Siddiqui. You can calibrate on how serious a problem these characters are, even if they are in the sort of stealth jihad mode rather than the overt, you know, violent form. And the combination, my point is, Sam, that we have to contend with here is Islamists with this agenda of bringing about, you know, the end of the United States in favor of some sort of Islamic caliphate may have a different end state in mind than the Marxists do, to be sure. But they're willing to work collaboratively to accomplish our takedown. And that's got to be absolutely chilling to a guy like you who's devoted as much as your life as you have to protecting our country against enemies foreign and domestic.
We're talking mass murder and we're talking the end of the United States. We're talking a true existential threat. There's, you got to get on one side of that or the other. If you're advocating in support of Afia Siddiqui, you're advocating for mass murder and the destruction of the United States. That's where you are. There isn't any middle ground there. And look, you and I were talking a couple of weeks ago at the Taliban glorifying 10th century Islamic warriors whose claim to fame was stacking skulls of non-believers. That's not a metaphor. That's real.
Right. No. Well, this is no drill, as they say. This is what these folks are about. And I think the stealth jihadists have to be held accountable and opposed formidably. Sam, let me turn to two other topics that you've covered recently in End Magazine. First is one with the wonderful title, Back in the USSR. It was written, as I recall, before Joe Biden addressed the question of Russia and Ukraine in that rambling press conference of his yesterday. But it is a very important piece that sort of creates a context for understanding what he was saying and its implications. Walk us through it.
Well, I mean, look, I think I said in a post that I put on social media the other day, you know, Putin versus Biden is kind of like throwing a puppy into a wood chipper. And I apologize for the imagery.
It's a little graphic.
Hopefully doesn't turn anybody off to the broadcast. But the point is, you know, we got a very hardcore guy in Putin who considers the dissolution of the Soviet Union the greatest tragedy of the 20th century, and who has dedicated himself to attempting as best he can to reconstitute the Soviet Union, versus a mentally incompetent, completely compromised lackey of the communist Chinese. And we are stumbling into absolute catastrophe here. We have no clear direction and we have no backbone. And we have, I mean, you know better than most, Frank, when it comes to this kind of stuff in national security and foreign policy, what you need is people with spine, but also clear-eyed, pragmatic individuals with a crystal clear idea of what our national interest is, because dancing around in a situation where we could end up in a military confrontation with the Russians is no place for incompetence and malfeasance, and that's right where we are.
So, Sam, just to cut to the chase on this, do you believe that what is now in prospect is a Russian full-on invasion of Ukraine, and that it is in our vital interest to oppose that, even if it comes down to, you know, becoming embroiled in military conflict with the Russian Federation?
Well, I look at it this way. The Russians have decided, Putin has decided, that their desire is to turn Ukraine back into, at a minimum, back into a Warsaw Pact style client state of Moscow. And there's blood in the water, and this is the opportunity which will never repeat itself with Biden and his gang of incompetence, and incompetence is being charitable. in the White House.
My concern is actually some of them are playing for the other team.
You've documented that. It's not just incompetence, it's malfeasance, and we've talked about that extensively. This is the opportunity of a lifetime. They are not going to miss this opportunity. And we at best have folks who have no idea what they're doing and no credibility. And as you and I have discussed many times, I think it's beyond that. As you just said, a number of them are playing for the other side. And this is going to end very, very badly. What I think we should have done was sit down with the Russians with a competent, pragmatic team some time ago and clarify exactly what we're talking about. If their fear is NATO tank divisions in Ukraine on the border with Russia, then potentially we can address that and resolve those fears. If their position is simply Ukraine must knuckle under and become a client state, then I don't think we can concede that. But we're not doing any of that. We're just, I mean, the Russian tank divisions will run across the border. My guess is their timetable is sometime first part to middle of February, based on everything that they're moving. And what will we do? Cluck from the sidelines, do nothing meaningful. And who knows what the Chinese will be doing in Taiwan and the Iranians will be doing in the Persian Gulf at the same time. This is a worldwide catastrophe in the making.
Sam, another potential catastrophe is the proliferation of missiles around the world. And you're warning that a new missile crisis may be in the offing. And at N Magazine, you've got a fresh off the presses piece about it. Tell us what you're concerned about in that regard and why we should be.
Well, I think there are very strong indications, including a number of comments from senior Russian officials, that suggest that the Russians are revisiting putting missiles into Venezuela and potentially into Cuba as well. So we're talking missiles that obviously can reach the United States, that are nuclear capable and potentially hypersonic, meaning, you know, if you fire one of these things from where the Russians have an existing base, well, on an island off the coast of Venezuela, you're talking about 5 minutes warning before that thing impacts the United States, if you're lucky. Under the best of all possible circumstances, again, these are nuclear capable weapons. This is revisiting the Cuban Missile Crisis on steroids. As I say in the article, Khrushchev misjudged Kennedy. You know, when they met about a year prior to the Cuban Missile Crisis, he judged Kennedy to be a weakling and a guy he could shove around. He discovered that he had forgotten the part where the guy was a World War II combat vet, and underneath the veneer was somebody who knew a little bit about war and would not be bullied. He's clearly made the correct calculation that Joe Biden is not JFK. There's nothing there. Again, that's the best case. That's before we get to all the indications that the guy is taking orders from Xi Jinping. So nobody's going to push back on Vlad at this point if he puts those missiles into Venezuela, I don't think. I mean, Joe Biden's going to order us to stop that? That's the guy who just presided over the debacle in Afghanistan and had to beg the Taliban to pretty please let us get our people out alive. I mean, it's not a serious thing. His UN ambassador is chiding the Russians, and you're like, this is Thomas Greenfield, our UN ambassador, most famous for praising the Chinese role in Africa and chastising the United States for being an inherently racist nation of white supremacists. So I suspect that she's not really terrifying Vladimir Putin. I don't think that's making him back down.
Yeah, and as you say, Sam, these folks have had long experience with Joe Biden. This isn't just post-Afghanistan. This isn't just in the face of the Nord Stream 2 decision. They've taken his measure for many years, and I think it's fair to say Vladimir Putin has not concealed his contempt for the man. So all of this seems likely to translate into a conflict in the not too distant future. And whether it actually begins there or whether it begins in Taiwan with China or India, perhaps, or whether it begins with Iran and Israel. It seems to me that it's pretty likely that it is going to include at least military operations by the Russians against the Ukrainians. And we will find ourselves hard-pressed to contend with any of it, let alone all of it. So all the more reason why we've got to be robust, as you say. We've got to be credibly deterring to the extent we can all comers at this moment. Hey, Sam, as we've been speaking, I've just been alerted to a story which you probably haven't seen yet, but the Associated Press is reporting that your old outfit, albeit in the form of an unnamed senior CIA official, has concluded that, quote, "We assess it is unlikely that a foreign actor, including Russia, is conducting a sustained worldwide campaign harming U.S. personnel with a weapon or mechanism." And he's speaking in this context of the so-called Havana syndrome. You were alluding to Cuba a moment ago, in which now for some years, I think we've had there and elsewhere, episodes in which it's been reported, at least, that American diplomats, CIA personnel, I think, and military as well, have been subjected to some kind of electromagnetic weapon or other device. But apparently, according to the CIA, there's nothing to see here, folks. It's just environmental factors or underlying medical conditions or stress that are causing these forces. Your thoughts, sir?
Well, actually, I did see that story. You know, anytime you got a whole bunch of reports, I'm perfectly willing to consider that some of those reports are folks who are kind of imagining things or things that are getting lumped into the same pot that aren't really the same. I don't buy that. I don't buy that conclusion. I mean, my personal theory, my personal belief based on my experience, and this is not based on access to current stuff, but is that what you're dealing with is you're dealing with some sort of ultrasonic, not really a weapon, but an ultrasonic listening device. This is a, there's been going on for decades where you basically bounce sound waves off of surfaces in a target building, and essentially you turn windows or even items inside the window into a microphones. I mean, basically, it's, they become diaphragms like you have in a telephone, old school telephone. And so you beam sound waves at the building, and essentially what you can do is, without ever getting access to the building, you can hear what's being said inside. With the unfortunate result in this case, I think that you also do some significant damage to everybody that's standing around in that building, even though they can't actually hear consciously the sound waves. So that's my personal theory. I'm sure it's very convenient for somebody to say that right now, because it's a sort of get the Russians off the hook statement. See, nothing to see here. The Russians really aren't hurting our people. Move along, kind of stuff.
But there are 1,000 or so reported cases, and I think, as you say, some of them may have other explanations. But I said EMP, I meant radio frequency or perhaps sonic, whatever it was. It obviously had predictable collateral effects on humans, like microwaving them, for God's sake. You know, it's not good for their health. Sam, let me switch gears, if I can, to another topic that that I know is top of mind for you. And again, we sort of touched on it before. There is now a commitment from the House Minority Leader, Kevin McCarthy, that should he become, as he aspires to be, the Speaker of the House of Representatives in the next session of Congress, as a result of presumably a rather substantial change of electoral fortune, shall we say, Eric Swalwell will be one of the people that he removes from the Intelligence Committee in the House of Representatives. Another would be Adam Schiff. You have thought long and hard about what these sorts of individuals have been doing to our country in those positions. And I would just invite you to talk a little bit about why this step is obviously important, but so ridiculously overdue as to be absolutely scandalous.
Well, I think as we've talked about many times, Frank, if you actually objectively look at what the Chinese are doing in the United States and have been doing for many, many, many years, from an intelligence perspective, we are not simply talking about stealing secrets, although certainly we are talking about that on a scale that's probably unprecedented. I mean, the Chinese are looting, Chinese Communist Party looting this country of every strategic secret you can think of. Their clear goal, right, is to achieve technological dominance over us. That's announced overtly, and they are rapidly stealing everything that we think gives us a critical advantage, even in military matters. But beyond that, what they've done is pursue an effort to co-opt officials from actually the state level on up to pursue policies favorable to them. They have bought and paid for not just Eric Swalwell, but I would submit any number of other folks. In fact, as I've said many times, including the president of the United States, absolutely unprecedented. This, by the way, all intelligence services do this to some extent. Nobody has ever done it on this scale, and it is a truly strategic issue that we are in this confrontation. You can just you imagine it's the 1980s. We're at the height of the Cold War, and Moscow has achieved this level of success of buying the leadership of the United States. Not that they didn't try, not that they didn't have some success. That's not what I'm saying. This is an old communist playbook. But they would have never dreamed of this level of success. And yet, I think because the Chinese have successfully exploited the weakness of a capitalist system, which is greed, they've gotten us to climb in bed with them economically in a way we would never have done with the USSR. They have this access. And so you got Swalwell, but right now, so Trump initially, I give you an example of just a tiny concrete example of the result of this buying of influence. Donald Trump, under Donald Trump, we initiated something called the China Initiative with DOJ and the FBI pushing back on Chinese espionage in this country, where they're looting everything, just carrying it lock, stock, and barrel off to Beijing. And we pushed back. That China Initiative is being dismantled right now. In fact, I think yesterday they dropped yet another case. DOJ said, apologized to some Chinese scientists, said, sorry for calling you a spy. We're dropping all the charges. And look at how many, you can see the hearings and the things going on in Congress on this, and you will see it's not just Eric Swalwell. There's a whole bunch of congressmen up there on Capitol Hill who are aghast that we would be arresting Chinese spies. We've got congressmen sitting on Capitol Hill that think we're being too mean to the North Koreans, apparently. Right, that they want us to sign a peace treaty, declare the war over, and establish full diplomatic relations with that insane.
At the very moment that the North Koreans are now talking about beginning to test once again nuclear weapons and long-range ballistic missiles capable of reaching
absolutely
this country. I mean,
this is
madness. Sam, we have to leave it at that. I do want to come back to you next week if we can on this China initiative, which, as you say, seems to be in the process of being dismantled at the insistence of friends of China in Congress and the executive branch and elsewhere, I'm sure. And this is a very, very problematic idea, and one that should be resisted forcefully if we can. Well, let me correct that. Should be resisted as strongly as we can, because truly, this is a problem of enemies without and within coming together, and both must be stymied. My friend, thank you for your time today. Thank you for the great service you've rendered to our country over so many years. I hope that you will continue to do so at the Committee on the Present Danger, China, and antmagazine.com. Good health and We appreciate you. We'll talk with you soon. We'll talk with the rest of you again, I hope, tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. What the president meant to say is bureaucraties for damage limitation when the nation's chief executive makes policy via unscripted pronouncements. It kicked in after Joe Biden signaled during yesterday's press conference that Russia could use a little military force against Ukraine with impunity. The uproar that ensued on both sides of the Atlantic prompted the White House immediately to affirm that the president meant to tell Vladimir Putin that any military action by his forces would result in, quote, a swift, severe, and united response, unquote. Unfortunately, long before this telegraphed Biden dive, his humiliating Afghan surrender and collapse on impeding Putin's Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline, the Russian dictator knew what Americans are still learning to their horror. This president is no match for ruthless tyrants, and not just Ukraine, but the world is likely soon to suffer greatly as a result. This is Frank Gaffney.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder of the American Freedom Law Center, a national public interest law firm that fights for faith and freedom in federal and state courts across the country. Make no mistake, we are living in dangerous times. Left-wing progressives in government are assaulting our Constitution like no other time in the history of our great nation. Indeed, we hear politicians at the highest levels of government and a major political party espousing what they believe to be the benefits of socialism and the unrestrained growth of the federal government. Fortunately, our Constitution was designed to prevent tyranny and to protect liberty. It enshrines fundamental freedoms in the Bill of Rights, which was designed as a brake on the power of government. In short, our Constitution was designed to protect private citizens like you and me from the tyranny of government. I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center will do its part to hold tyrannical government officials accountable in our courts of law so that we, the people, remain a free people. You can support the important work of the American Freedom Law Center with a tax-deductible donation. Please visit our website at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
History was made on today's date. Stay tuned for an American Minute with Bill Federer.
On this day, January 20th, 1961, President John F. Kennedy delivered his inaugural address following prayers by a rabbi, a Protestant minister, a Catholic cardinal, a Greek Orthodox bishop, and a poem by Robert Frost. President Kennedy stated, "The same revolutionary beliefs for which our forebears fought are still at issue around the globe. The belief that the rights of man come not from the generosity of the state, but from the hand of God." President Kennedy concluded, "Let us go forth asking his blessing and his help, knowing that here on earth, God's work must truly be our own."
This has been an American Minute with Bill Federer. For a free transcript, call American Minute at 1-888-USA-WORD.